Cassette 3, Side 2.
Chapter 16. Galactics. Rejoice, crooned the fourth brother of the ebony shadows. Rejoice that the fifth moon of the small dusty planet has been conquered. The brothers of the night had fought bitterly for this fulcrum of power, from which they would soon project irresistible might to sweep the skies of heretics and blasphemers. This moon would guarantee that the prize would be theirs, and theirs alone. None of the other moons in the Casthemony system had the one attribute this one possessed, a core of almost 1% unobtainium. Already 30 of the brothers' ships had landed to begin construction of the weapon. The library, as always, had been the key. Many cycles ago, the fourth brother of the Ebony Shadows had come across an obscure reference to a device once used in a war between two races now long extinct. It had taken half his lifespan to hunt down the details, for the library was a labyrinth. But now would come his payment. "Rejoice!" the cry resounded. It was a paean of triumph meant to be heard, and, indeed, a few other combatants began to notice that something curious was going on, over in the corner of Clisemini's system. While the fiercest battles raged around the strategic gas giant world and Kithrop itself, some enemies had begun sending scouts this way to see what the Brothers of the Night were up to. "Let them come and look. Can it matter?" A ship of the Sorrow had been watching them for some time. Could it have divined their purpose? Never. The citation was too obscure. "Our new weapon has sat unnoticed too long in the dusty archives. They will first understand when this moon begins to vibrate on the 15th probability band, sending out waves of uncertainty that will tear their battle fleets apart. Then their shipboard libraries will undoubtedly remember, but too late." The brother of the Ebony Shadows watched from space as the resonator neared completion, watched as grounded ships fed their combined energies to the resonator. From 1,000 units out, he could feel the wave build. What are they doing? What are the progenitor scorned Sorrow doing? Instruments showed that the Brothers of the Night were not alone on the 15th band. From the Sorrow ship came a small tone, a variation of the beat emanating from the small moon, an echo. The 15th band began to throb. Impossibly, it resonated along with the Sorrow rhythm. The brothers on the ground tried to damp the runaway signal, but it was already too late. The small moon shook and finally crumbled. Great shards of rock tumbled apart, crushing the little ships in their way. How could they have known? How could they? Then the brother of the Ebony Shadows understood. Long ago, when he had begun his search for a new weapon, there had been a helpful librarian, a Pelan. The Pelan had always been there with the useful suggestion, with the helpful reference. The brother had thought nothing of it. Librarians were supposed to be helpful and neutral, whatever their backgrounds. But the pill are clients to the Sorrow, the brother realized. Krat knew all along. He gave the order, sending his remaining forces into hiding. "This is only a setback. We shall yet be the ones to capture the Earthlings." Behind the fleeing remnants, the small moon continued to dissolve. Chapter 17. Tom Orley. Honest Suessi lay prone on the heavy work sled next to Thomas Orley. The gaunt, balding artificer gestured at the wreck before them. "It's a Thenanan ship," the chief engineer said. "It's pretty badly crumpled, but there's no doubt. See? No objectivity anchors, only stasis projectors on the main flanges. The Thenanin are terrified of reality alteration. This ship was never designed to use a probability drive. Definitely Thenanin, or a Thenanin client or ally. The dolphins circled slowly nearby, taking turns at the air domes underneath the sled, emitting excited sonar clicks as they eyed the gigantic crushed arrowhead below them.
"I think you're right, Hannes," Tom said. "It's a behemoth."
That the ship was still in one piece was amazing. In its Mach 5 meeting with the ocean, it had caromed off at least two subsurface islands, leaving substantial dents in them, and plowed a deep gouge in the ocean floor before finally catching up against a furrow of pelagic mud, just before it would have smashed into a sheer scarp. The cliff face looked crumbly and precarious. Another substantial jolt would surely cause a collapse, burying the wreck completely. Orly knew it was the quality of the Thenanin stasis shields that made such a performance possible. Even in dying, a Thenanin ship was reputed to be not worth putting out of its misery. In battle they were slow, unmaneuverable, and as hard to disable permanently as a cockroach. It was difficult to assess the damage. Down here the illumination from the surface was blue-tinged and dim. The Fen wouldn't turn on the arc lights they had strung up until Tisht said it was safe. Fortunately, the wreck was in water shallow enough to visit, yet deep enough to shield them from spy eyes overhead. A pink-bellied bottlenose dolphin swam up next to the sled. She worked her food mouth in a thoughtful circular motion.
"It's really amazing, isn't it, Tom?" she asked. "It should be in a jillion pieces."
This deep, there was an odd clarity to the Finn's voice. Bursts of air from her blowmouth and sonar clicks joined in a complex manner to make speech an intricate juggling of bodily functions. To a landlubber human, a neo-dolphin speaking underwater sounded more like an avant-garde orchestra tuning up than someone speaking a derivative of the English language.
"Do you think we can make any use of it?" the dolphin officer asked.
Orly looked again at the ship. There was a good chance that in the confusion of battle, none of those contending over Kithrop had bothered to note where this sparrow had fallen. He already had a few tentative ideas, one or two of which might be bold, unexpected, and idiotic enough to work.
"Let's give it a look," he nodded.
"I suggest we split into three groups. Team One heads for any center of emissions, particularly probability, psi, or neutrino radiation, and disables the source. They should also watch out for survivors, though that seems unlikely." Suessi snorted as he looked at the pounded wreck. Orly went on. "Team Two concentrates on harvesting. Hannes should lead that one, along with Tichja. They'll look for monopoles and refined metals Streaker can use. Well, with luck, they might find some replacements for those coils we need. With your permission, Tisht, I'll take Team Three. I want to look over the structural integrity of that ship and survey the topography of the surrounding area." Tisht performed a jaw clap of agreement.
"Your logic is good, Tom. That is what we'll do. I'll leave Lucky Ka with the other sled on alert. The rest shall join their teams at once."
Orly grabbed Tisht's dorsal fin as she was about to whistle the command. "Oh, we'd better go with breathers all around, hadn't we? Trinary may not be efficient, but I'd rather put off complex conversations in Anglic than have to risk everybody shuttling back and forth for air, and maybe someone getting hurt." Tisht grimaced, but gave the command. The party was composed of disciplined Fen, the pick of Streaker's crew, so the gathering at the sled was occasion merely for low-pitched grousing and indignant bubbles, as each dolphin was fitted with a wraparound hose of air. Tom had heard of prototype breathers that would give a Fen a streamlined air supply without hindering the speech mouth. If ever he found the time, he might try to rig some up himself. Speaking trinary posed no real difficulty for him, but he knew from experience that the Fen would have problems conveying technical information in anything but Anglic. Old Hannes was already grumbling. He helped pass out the breathers with ill-disguised reluctance. The chief artificer was conversant in trinary, of course, but he found the three-level logic difficult. To cap things off, he was a lousy poet. He obviously didn't look forward to trying to discuss technical matters in whistle rhyme. They had their work cut out for them. Several of the picked petty officers and crew that had accompanied them on the rescue effort had gone back to the ship, escorting Toshio and Hikahi and the other victims of the stranding waves. Only a short score of Fen remained in the party. Should anything dangerous come up, they would have to take care of it. No help from Streaker could arrive in time to do any good. It would have been nice to have Jillian here, Tom mused. Not that inspecting alien cruisers was her area of expertise, but she knew Fins and could handle herself if things got sticky. But she had work of her own aboard Streaker, trying to solve the puzzle of a billion-year-old mummy that should never have existed in the first place. And, in an emergency, she was the only other person aboard Streaker, barring possibly Crydike himself, who knew about the Nis machine. Tom smiled as he caught himself rationalizing again. Okay, so there are good and logical reasons why the two of us can't be together. Take it for what it's worth. Do a good job here, and maybe you can get back to her in a few days. There had never been any question, from the moment they had met as adolescents, that he and she would make a pair. He sometimes wondered if their planners had known in advance, in choosing gametes from selected married couples, that two of the growing zygotes would later fit so perfectly, down to the simple telepathy they sometimes shared. Probably it was a happy accident. Human genetic planning was limited by law and custom. Accident or no, Tom was grateful. In his missions for the Terrigan's Council, he had learned that the universe was dangerous and filled with disillusionment. Too few sophants, even those equipped for it, ever got enough love. As soon as the breathers had been distributed, Tom used the sled speaker to amplify his voice. Now, remember, everybody, though all galactic technologies are based on the library, that collection of wisdom is so huge that almost any type of machine might be inside that hull. Treat everything like it's booby-trapped until you've identified it and rendered it harmless. The first goal of Team One, after silencing the wreck, is to find the main battle computers. There may be a record of the initial stages of the fight above. That information might be invaluable to the captain. And would you all keep an eye out for the library glyph? If you find that symbol anywhere, please note its location and pass word to me. I'd like to see what kind of micro-branch they were carrying. He nodded to Tisht. Is that all right with you, Lieutenant? Streaker's fourth officer clapped jaw and nodded. Orly's politeness was appreciated, but she was likelier to bite off her own tail than overrule any suggestion he made. Streaker was the first large expedition ever commanded and operated by dolphins. It had been clear from the beginning that certain humans were along whose advice bore the patina of patronomy. She called out in trinary. Team One with me to diffract above listening. Team Two with Suessi to taste for treasure. Team Three with Orly to aid him scheming. Drop nothing of earth here to betray our visit. Clean it up after, if you must shit. Think before acting, in tropic-clear logic, now Streakers with stillness, away! In precise order, three formations peeled off, one group embellishing with a synchronized barrel roll as they passed Orly's sled. In obedience to Tisht's orders, the only sound was the rapid clicking of cetacean sonar. Orly rode the sled until he was within 40 meters of the hulk. Then he patted Hannes on the back and rolled off to the side. What a beautiful find the ship was. Worley used a hot-torch spectrograph to get a quick analysis of the metal at the edges of a gaping tear in the vessel's side. When he determined the ratios of various beta decay products, he whistled, causing the Fen nearby to turn and look at him curiously. He had to make assumptions about the original alloy and the rate of exposure to neutrinos since the metal was forged, but reasonable guesses indicated that the ship had been fabricated at least 30 million years ago. Tom shook his head. A fact like that made one realize how far mankind had to go to catch up with the Galactics. We like to think of the races using the library as being in a rut, uncreative and unadaptable, Orley thought. That appeared to be largely true. Very often the Galactic races seemed stodgy and unimaginative. But he looked at the dark, hulking battleship and wondered. Legend had it that the progenitors had called for a perpetual search for knowledge before they departed for parts unknown, eons ago. But in practice, most species looked to the library and only the library for knowledge. Its store grew only slowly. What was the point of researching what must have been discovered 1,000 times over by those who came before? It was simple, for instance, to choose advanced spaceship designs from library archives and follow them blindly, understanding only a fraction of what was built. Earth had a few such ships, and they were marvels. The Terrigan's Council, which handled relations between the races of Earth and the galactic community, once almost succumbed to that tempting logic. Many humans urged co-opting of galactic models that older races had themselves co-opted from ancient designs. They cited the example of Japan, which in the 19th century had faced a similar problem: how to survive amongst nations immeasurably more powerful than itself. Meiji Japan had concentrated all its energy on learning to imitate its neighbors, and succeeded in becoming just like them in the end. The majority of the Terrigan's Council, including nearly all of the Cetacean members, disagreed. They considered the library a honeypot, tempting and possibly nourishing, but also a terrible trap. They feared the Golden Age syndrome, the temptation to look backward, to find wisdom in the oldest, dustiest texts, instead of the latest journal. Except for a few races, such as the Kantan and Timbrimi, the galactic community as a whole seemed stuck in that kind of mentality. The library was their first and last recourse for every problem. The fact that the ancient records almost always contained something useful didn't make that approach any less repugnant to many of the wolflings of Earth, including Tom, Jillian, and their mentor, old Jacob Demois. Coming out of a tradition of bootstrap technology, Earth's leaders decided there were things to be gained from innovation, even this late in galactic history. At least, it felt better to believe that. To a wolfling race, pride was an important thing. Orphans often have little else. But here was evidence of the power of the Golden Age approach. Everything about this ship spoke silkily of refinement. Even in wreckage, it was beautifully simple in its construction, while indulgent and ornate in its embellishments. The eye saw no welds. Bracings and struts were always integral to some other purpose. Here one supported a stasis flange, while apparently also serving as a baffled radiator for excess probability. Orley thought he detected other overlaps, subtleties that could only have come with eons of slow improvement on an ancient design. He was struck by a decadence in the pattern, an ostentation that he found arrogant and bizarre beyond mere alienness. One of Tom's main assignments aboard Streaker had been evaluation of alien devices, particularly of the military variety. This wasn't the best the Galactics had, yet it made him feel like an ancient New Guinea headhunter, proud of his new muzzle-loading musket, but painfully aware of the fact of machine guns. He looked up. His team was gathering. He chinned his hydrophone switch. Everybody about done? All right, then. Subteam 2, head off and see if that canyon goes all the way through the ridge. It had cut 20 clicks off the route back to Streaker. He heard a whistle of assent from Karacha Jeff, leader of Subteam 2. Good. That fin was reliable. Be careful, he added as they swam off. Then he motioned for the others to follow him into the wreck through the seared, curled rent in its hull. They entered darkened corridors of eerily familiar design. Everywhere were signs of the commonality of galactic culture, superimposed with the idiosyncrasies of a peculiar alien race. The lighting panels were identical to those on ships of 100 species, but spaces in between were garishly decorated with Thenanin hieroglyphs. Orly identically examined it all. But always he looked for one thing, a symbol that could be found everywhere in the 5 linked galaxies, a rayed spiral. They'll tell me when they find it, he reminded himself. The Finns know I'm interested. I do hope, though, they don't suspect just how badly I want to see that glyph. Chapter 18 Jillian.
Oh, why should I, huh? You aren't being very cooperative with me. All I want is to talk to Brukita for just a minute. It's not as if I was asking a lot.
Jillian Baskin felt tired and irritable. The holo image of the chimpanzee paleontologist Charles Dart glared out at her. It would be easy to become scathing and force Charlie to retreat. But then he would probably complain to Ignacio Metz, and Metz would lecture her about bullying people just because they are clients. Crap. Gillian wouldn't take from a human being what she had put up with from this self-important little neo-chimp. She brushed aside a strand of dark blonde hair that had fallen over her eyes.
Charlie, for the last time, Brukita is sleeping. He has received your message and will call you when McAnee says he's had enough rest. In the meantime, all I want from you is a listing of isotope abundances for the transferic elements here on Kithrop. We've just finished more than 4 hours surgery on Satima, and we need that data to design a chelating sequence for her. I want to get every microgram of heavy metal out of her body as soon as possible. Now, if that's too much to ask, if you're too overworked studying little geological puzzles, I'll just call the captain or Takata Jim and ask them to assign somebody to go down and help you.
The chimp scientist grimaced. His lips curled back to display an array of large yellowed buck teeth. At the moment, in spite of the enlarged globe of his cranium, his outthrust jaw, and his opposable thumbs, he looked more like an angry ape than a sapient scientist.
Oh, all right.
His hands fluttered, and emotion made him stammer.
But this is important. Understand? I think Kithrop was inhabited by technological sophons as recently as 30,000 years ago. Yet the Galactic Migration Institutes had this planet posted as fallow and untouchable for the last 100 million.
Jillian suppressed an urge to say, "So what?" There had been more defunct and forgotten species in the history of the 5 galaxies than even the library could count. Charlie must have read her expression.
"It's illegal,"
he shouted. His coarse voice cracked.
"If it's true, the Institute of Migration should be told. They might even be grateful enough to help get those crazy religious nuts overhead to let us alone."
Jillian lifted an eyebrow in surprise. What was this? Charles Dart pondering implications beyond his own work? Even he, then, must think from time to time about survival. His argument about the laws of migration were naive, considering how often the codes were twisted and perverted by the more powerful clans. But he deserved some credit.
"Okay, that's a good point, Charlie," she said. "I'm having dinner with the captain later. I'll mention it to him then. I'll also ask McKinney if she'll let Brukita out a little early. Good enough?"
Charlie looked at her with suspicion. Then, unable to maintain so subtle and intermediate an expression for long, he let a broad grin spread.
"Good enough," he rumbled. "And you'll have that fax in hand within 4 minutes. I leave you in good health."
"Health,"
Jillian replied softly, as the holo faded. She spent a long moment staring at the blank comm screen. With her elbows on the desk, her face settled down upon the palms of her hands.
"Ifni, I should have been able to handle an angry Chim better than that. What's the matter with me?"
Jillian gently rubbed her eyes.
"Well, I've been up for 26 hours, for one thing."
A long and unproductive argument about semantics with Tom's damned sarcastic Nis machine hadn't helped at all, when all she had wanted from the thing was its assistance on a few obscure library references. It knew she needed help to crack the mystery of Herbie, the ancient cadaver that lay under glass in her private lab. But it kept changing the subject, asking her opinion on various irrelevant issues, such as human sexual mores. By the time the session was through, Jillian was ready to disassemble the nasty thing with her bare hands. But Tom would probably disapprove, so she deferred. She had been about to go to bed when the emergency call came from the outlock. Soon she was busy helping McKinney and the autodocs treat survivors of the survey party. Worry about Hikahi and Satima drove all thought of sleep from her mind until that was done. Now that they seemed to be out of danger, Jillian could no longer use adrenaline reaction to hold off that empty feeling that seeped in around the edges of a very rough day. "It's not a time to enjoy being alone," she thought. She lifted her head and looked at her reflection in the blank comm screen. Her eyes were reddened, from overwork, certainly, but also worry. Jillian knew well enough how to cope, but coping was a sterile solution. Instinct demanded warmth, someone to hold and satisfy that physical longing. She wondered if Tom felt the same way at this moment. Oh, of course he did. With the crude telepathic link they shared, Jillian felt she knew him well. They were of a type, the two of them. Only sometimes it seemed to Jillian the planners had been more successful with him than with her. While everyone seemed to think of her as superbly competent, they were all a bit in awe of Thomas Orley. And at times like the present, when eidetic recall seemed more a curse than a blessing, Jillian wondered if she really was as neurosis-free as the manufacturer's warranty promised. The fax on her desk extruded a hard copy message. It was the isotope distribution profile promised by Charlie. A minute ahead of schedule, she noted. Jillian scanned the columns. Good. There was little variation from the millennia-old library report on Kithrop. Not that she expected any, but one always checked. A brief appendix at the bottom warned that these profiles were only valid in the surface crust and upper asthenosphere regions, and were invalid any more than 2 kilometers below the surface. Jillian smiled. Someday Charlie's compulsiveness might save them all. She stepped from her office onto a parapet above a large open chamber. Water filled the central part of the room up to 2 meters below the parapet. Bulky machines stuck out above. The upper half of the chamber, including Jillian's office, was inaccessible to dolphins, unless they came riding a walker or spider. Jillian didn't bother with the folded face mask at her belt. She looked below, then dove, plunging between two rows of dark auto docks. The large oblong glassite containers were silent and empty. All the waterways of sickbay were shallow to allow open breathing and dry surgery. She swam with long, strong strokes, gripped the corner of one machine to make a turn, and passed through a strip door into the trauma unit. She surfaced, open-mouthed for air, bobbed for a moment, then swam over to a wall of thick leaded glass. Two bandaged dolphins floated in a heavily shielded gravity tank. One occupant, connected to a maze of tubing, had the dull-eyed look of heavy sedation. The other whistled cheerfully as Jillian approached.
"I greet you, life cleaner. Your potions scour my veins, but it's this taste of weightlessness which lifts my spacer's heart. Thank you."
"You're welcome, Hikahi."
Jillian treaded water easily, not bothering with the curb and rail near the gravity tank.
"Just don't get too used to the comfort. I'm afraid McKinney and I are going to kick you out soon, as penalty for having such an iron constitution."
"As opposed to one of bismuth or cadmium?"
Hikahi spluttered a raspberry-like chuckle. Jillian laughed.
"Indeed. And being healthy will be your tough luck. We'll have you out of here breathing bubbles and standing on your tail for the captain in no time."
Hikahi gave her small neo-fin a smile.
"You're certain this isn't too risky, turning on this gravity tank? I wouldn't want Satima and me to be responsible for giving the show away."
"Relax, Femfin," Jillian shook her head. "We triple-checked. The leak detection buoys aren't picking up a thing. Enjoy it, and don't worry."
"Oh, and I hear the captain may be sending a small team back to your island to examine those pre-sentients you found. I figured you'd be interested. It's a sign he's not worried about galactics in the short term. The space battle may last a long time, and we might be able to hide indefinitely."
"An indefinite stay on Kithrop's not my idea of paradise."
Hikahi opened her mouth in a grin of irony.
"If that's meant as cheery news, please warn me when your message is depressing."
Jillian laughed.
"I will. Now you get some sleep. Shall I turn down the light?"
"Yes, please. And Jillian, thanks for the news. I do think it's very important we do something about the Abos. I hope the expedition is a success. Tell Crydike I'll be back on duty before he can open a can of tuna."
"I will. Pleasant dreams, dear."
Jillian touched the dimmer switch, and the lights gradually faded. Hikahi blinked several times, apparently settling into a seaman's nap. Jillian headed for the outer clinic, where McKinney would be dealing with a line of complaining crewfen at sick call. Jillian would show the physician Charlie's isotope profiles, and then go back to her own lab to work for a while longer. Sleep called to her, but she knew it would be a long time coming. In this mood that had come upon her, she felt reluctant. Logic was the blessing and curse of her upbringing. She knew that Tom was where he was supposed to be, out pursuing ways to save them all. He knew it as well. His departure had been hasty and necessary, and there simply hadn't been time to seek her out to say goodbye. Jillian was aware of all these considerations. She repeated them to herself as she swam, but they only seemed to disconnect the larger from the smaller of her problems, and rob of poignant consolation the unattractiveness of her empty bed. Chapter 19 Crydike. "K'neek is a study of relationships," he told his audience. "That part comes from our dolphin heritage. K'neek is also a study of strict comparisons. This second part we learned from our human patrons. K'neek is a synthesis of two worldviews, much as we ourselves are. About 30 neo-dolphins floated across from him, bubbles rising slowly from their blowmouths, intermittent unconscious sonar clicks their only sound. Since there were no humans present, Krydike did not have to use the crisp consonants and long vowels of standard Anglic. But transcribed onto paper, his words would have pleased any English grammarian. "Consider reflections from the surface of the ocean, where the air meets the water," he suggested to his pupils. "What do the reflections tell us?" He saw puzzled expressions. "Reflections from which side of the water, you wonder? Do I speak of the reflections felt from below the interface, or from above? Moreover, do I mean reflections of sound, or of light?" He turned to one of the attentive dolphins. "Watasetti, imagine yourself one of our ancestors. Which combination would occur to you?" The engine room tech blinked. "Sound images, Captain. A pre-sentient dolphin would have thought of sound reflections in the water bouncing against the surface from below." The tech sounded tired, but Watasetti still attended these sessions in a fervent desire for self-improvement. It was for the morale of Fenn like Watasetti that the busy captain made time to continue them. Krydike nodded. "Quite right. Now, what would be the first type of reflection thought of by a human?"
"The image of light from above," the mess chief, Stat, answered promptly.
"Most probably, though we all know that even some of the big ears can eventually learn to hear." There was a general scree of laughter at the harmless little put-down of the patron race. Laughter was a measure of crew morale, and he weighed it as he might test the mass of a fuel cell by hefting it between his jaws. Krydike noticed for the first time that Takata Jim and Kathod John had swum up to join the group. Krydike quashed a momentary concern. Takata Jim would have signaled if something had come up. He seemed to be here simply to listen. If this was a sign the vice-captain was ending his long, unexplained sulk, Krydike was glad. He had kept Takata Jim aboard instead of sending him out to accompany Orly and the rescue party, because he wanted to keep his exec under scrutiny. He had reluctantly begun to think the time might have come to make changes in the chain of command. He waited for the snickering to die down. "Consider now, how are a human's thoughts about these reflections from the surface of the water similar to our own?" The students assumed expressions of concentration. This would be the next-to-last problem. With so much repair work to oversee, Krydike had been tempted to cancel the sessions altogether, but so many in the crew wanted desperately to learn Kanik. At the beginning of the voyage, almost all the Fen had participated in the lectures, games, and athletic competitions that helped stave off spaceflight ennui. But since the frightening episode at the shallow cluster, when a dozen crew Fen had been lost exploring the terrifying derelict fleet, some had begun to detach themselves from the community of the ship, to associate with their own little groups. Some even began exhibiting a strange atavism, increasing difficulty with Anglic, and the sort of concentrated thought needed by a spacer. Krydike had been forced to juggle schedules to find replacements. He had given Takata Jim the task of finding jobs for the reverted ones. The task seemed to suit the vice-captain. With the aid of Bosun Kathod John, he seemed to have found useful work for even the worst stricken. Krydike carefully listened to the swish of flukes, the uncomfortable gurgling of gill lungs, the rhythm of heartbeats. Takata Jim and Kathod John floated quietly, apparently attentive, but Krydike sensed in each of them an underlying tension. Krydike shivered. There had come a suddenly vivid mental image of the vice-captain's shrewd, sullen eye and the bosun's great, sharp teeth. He suppressed it, chiding himself for an overactive imagination. There was no logical reason to fear either of those two. We are contemplating reflections from an interface between air and water. He hurriedly resumed his lecture. Both humans and dolphins envision a barrier when they consider such a surface. On the other side is a realm that is only faintly apparent until the barrier is crossed. Yet the modern human, with his tools, does not fear the water side as he once did. The neo-fin, with his tools, can live and work in the air, and look down without discomfort. Consider how your own thoughts stretched out when I asked my original question. The idea of sound reflecting from below came to mind first. Our ancestors would have complacently stopped with that first generalization. But you did not stop there. You did not generalize without considering further alternatives. This is a common hallmark of planning creatures. For us, it is a new thing. The timer on Krydike's harness chimed. It was growing late. Tired as he was, he still had a meeting to attend, and he wanted to stop at the bridge to find out if there had been any word from Orly. How does a cetacean, whose heritage, whose very brain, is built on intuitive thinking, learn to analyze a complex problem, piece by piece? Sometimes the key to an answer is found in the way you formulate the question. I'll leave you all today with an exercise for your idle moments. Try to state the problem of reflections from the surface of water in trinary, in a way that demands not a single answer or a three-level opposition, but a plain listing of the reflections that are possible. He saw several of the fen frown uncomfortably. The captain smiled reassuringly. I know, it sounds difficult, and I will not ask you to recite today, but just to show you it can be done, accept the echo of this dream. A layer divides sky star, sea star. What comes to us at a narrow angle? The hunt-squeaking, star-catching octopus reflects. The night-calling, star-following tern reflects. The star twinkle in my lover's eye reflects. The sun, soundless, roaring show-off, reflects. Krydike was adequately rewarded by the wide-eyed appreciation of his audience. As he turned to go, he noticed that even Takata Jim was shaking his head slowly, as if considering a thought that had never occurred to him before. After the meeting broke up, Katha John persisted in his argument.
You saw, you heard him, Takata Jim?
I saw and heard, Bosun, and as usual I was impressed. Krydike is a genius. So what is it you wanted to point out to me?
Katha John clapped his jaw, not the most polite gesture to make before a superior officer.
He says nothing about the galactics, nothing about the siege, nothing at all about plans to get us away from here, or, barring that, to fight. And meanwhile he ignores the growing split amongst the crew.
Takata Jim let out a line of bubbles.
A split you have busily been encouraging, Katha John. No, don't bother protesting innocence. You've been subtle, and I know you've been doing it to build a power base for me. So I look away. But don't be sure Krydike will always be too busy to notice. When he does notice, Katha John, watch your tail, for I won't have known a thing about your little tricks.
Katha John blew quiet bubbles, not bothering to reply.
As for Krydike's plans, we'll see. We'll see if he's willing to listen to Dr. Metz and myself, or if he persists in this dream of carting secrets back to Earth unopened.
Takata Jim saw the giant Stenos was about to interrupt.
Yes, I know you think we should consider a third option, don't you? You'd like to see us head out and take on all the galactic single-handed, wouldn't you, Katha John?
The huge dolphin didn't answer, but his eye gleamed back at the vice-captain.
Are you my Boswell, my Seton, my Igor, or my Iago? Takata Jim thought silently at the giant mutant. You serve me now, but in the long run, am I using you, or are you using me?
This ends side 2 of cassette 3.